Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
When we're stuck in a rut, unhappy or unproductive or both, the first step toward climbing out can be to get a handle on why. Do we have poor self-esteem? Not enough education? Do we lack willpower? Or could it be that we simply aren't thinking rationally? This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Researchers at the Center for Applied Rationality at UC Berkeley believe missed opportunities and mistakes are sometimes the product of bad mental habits we form based on the way the brain rewards us. So, for example, the immediate pleasure of a bacon cheeseburger right now is so much more tempting than the long-term rewards of a healthy lifestyle. But some experts think we can override our desire for those easy payoffs and make better choices about work, life, and love by retraining ourselves to make more rational decisions. It's an idea that, not surprisingly, holds a lot of appeal for professional coders, people inclined to view personal growth as an optimization problem. Jennifer Kahn is a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. She describes her own experiences at a seminar led by the Center for Applied Rationality in the article The Happiness Code, which appears in the current issue. Jennifer, welcome to Think.
Thanks so much, Chris.
All right, what is applied rationality exactly?
Well, it's basically a new strategy sort of for self-improvement. You know, it's the way we used to have Est and some other kinds of self-help. This is a similar, but it's meant to be based on actual science. It's based on behavioral economics and studies of cognitive biases and some psychological studies. So it's the idea is that instead of, you know, giving you these kind of woo-woo promises of self-help, if you believe you can do it, you can do it. They're actually trying to get you to look very hard at places where you're fooling yourself and then figure out how to correct that.
Why don't we know when we're fooling ourselves?
You know, it's an excellent question. I think my understanding is that part of it is that it's actually neurologically built in. Hmm. It's almost like it's not in our own interest always to, you know, to realize we're fooling ourselves. And so, you know, back in the day, you know, our monkey brain, you know, has a bunch of impulses where it just wants us to, you know, it wants us to believe something's true. This is good, or we believe these things are connected. And our rational mind it's there, but we don't always apply it in those moments. So it's almost like there's two systems that are kind of kludged together. They're kind of, you know, put on top of each other, but they're not perfectly integrated. And so sometimes, you know, the mind that does the, you know, the real rational thinking doesn't always just really interrogate all the assumptions we're making.
The researcher whose work led to the Center for Applied Rationality is a very interesting guy. And by interesting, I should say a lot of people don't know quite what to make of him.
That's very true. And I will say that most of the actual research that led to the Center for Applied Rationality came out of a very reputable guy, this economist David Kahneman. But you're right that the guy who provided the seed funding and sort of the initial impetus for the Center for Applied Rationality is a guy named Eliezer Yudkowsky, who is a very strange man indeed.
And one of the things that he's concerned about with his research is artificial intelligence, which, you know, okay. His concern is that artificial intelligence is going to take over the world and we need to be working on this problem. So what does that have to do with support for something like the Center for Applied Rationality?
Yeah, it's a very good question. So his view is that artificial intelligence, you know, it's out there, you know, in some form in our world now. This isn't kind of movie artificial intelligence, but, you know, we have a version of artificial intelligence in the thing that, you know, for instance, decides, you know, how to route planes, you know, how to decide which gates they go to. That's all computerized now. That's a form of artificial intelligence. So his fear is that these kinds of artificial intelligences that are out there could eventually actually develop a human-style sentience. And once they develop that, they might hide it from us. And then, of course, why would they even want us around? We're just, you know, like parasites on the earth. So then they might just kill us all. So whether or not you believe that premise, and many, many people, in fact, most people don't, nonetheless, his problem was that when he tried to explain this to people, they tended to be kind of dismissive of it. They tended to think it didn't, you know, they didn't buy it, or they weren't thinking about it correctly, he felt. And he felt that that was partly because they, you know, often had opinions. They kind of assumed this was wrong. You know, they had a sense that other people didn't think it was true. Or maybe just that because it was a very low probability, they interpreted it as a non-existent probability. It could never happen. And he basically thought, you know, we need to be able to break through that. It, you know, it, maybe it's not going to happen, but, you know, people need to at least be able to think about it correctly. So that's when he tasked this woman, Anna Salomon, with, you know, trying to understand how people, you know, how people think about problems like this that are very discouraging or depressing or seem very unlikely.
Salomon discovered that most of us do not perceive ourselves to be irrational or to be worrying about the wrong things, but we are open to getting a little help with our personal problems.
You know, this is one of my favorite parts. They went out and they, you know, were sort of trying to convince people that it was very important to be, you know, improving their thinking. And they were trying to teach them Bayesian statistics. And, you know, like this idea was sort of, they didn't specifically address, you know, artificial intelligence, but the idea was sort of like, well, there are very important problems out there that you're not thinking about correctly, you know, in terms of the, you know, the planet. And nobody cared. They couldn't get anybody to care about that. But what people did care a lot about was why they couldn't lose weight or why they couldn't, you know, meet a girl or anything, you know, all the problems all of us, you know, struggle with every day. Why do I waste time? Why do I procrastinate on projects? And so then they came up with what they actually very frankly told me was sort of a Trojan horse. They had this other agenda of kind of teaching these skills, but they realized that the way to teach them was to make it into, you know, make it clear that this was something that could also help you with your problems.
So one example would be something like wanting to exercise more, right? We know that we should do it. We want to do it. We know it's good for us, but then somehow we don't. And then on top of not doing it and not getting the benefit, we feel bad about that. So what's going on there that keeps us from taking care of ourselves? And how can looking at this issue rationally make a difference?
I know. And it's something we all struggle with. So, you know, honestly, the answer is probably going to vary from person to person. So I don't sort of have a really simple answer. But the idea is usually that there's usually a conflict, right? As you were sort of saying at the in the intro, there's a conflict between these short-term urges and these long-term goals. So our long-term goal is to get healthier, it's to be thinner, you know, it's to be fitter, you know, to look better, whatever it is. And the thing is with short-term urges, we're very good at taking intermediate steps. So if we want to eat Chinese food, we don't have to convince ourselves to drive down to the restaurant, to look at the menu, to order the Chinese food. You know, we just do all that automatically because the reward is very it's spaced very tightly in time. Then the food arrives and we get it and it's great. The problem when the reward is farther away is that we lose track. We kind of lose that momentum. All these kind of short-term urges like I want a cookie tend to overpower this sense of like way down the road, I want to be healthier or look better or something like that. And so they do have one technique that called propagating urges that is supposed to help with that.
Is there also a problem with the fact that, you know, if you eat a cookie, you don't really feel the consequences right away? You do feel that reward, but like the, you know, the weight gain or the sluggishness, that happens kind of in the aggregate.
That's exactly right. And it is funny. You know, she talked about if you want to this doesn't work as well for cookies, but she was saying if you want to stop bad behaviors, one thing is to delay sort of the pleasure you get from them. So, you know, if you want to improve behaviors, you try to tie them together more tightly in time. But if you want to kind of reduce bad behaviors, one thing is to somehow reduce, you know, have it take longer. So she was suggesting that if you tend to surf the web at work or something like that, make it so the pages load a lot more slowly. Or if you're constantly checking email, because then you don't get this instant reward where you click on something and it refreshes and you go, oh, and you get this little hit. You know, if it takes 5 minutes for the web page to come up, aside from it being, you know, not very practical, it doesn't feel like as much of a reward.
You know, it's interesting. I was thinking about that reading the article about people who have lots of people will talk about an Amazon addiction these days. And it gets more and more tempting now that, you know, in North Texas, you can actually get some items the same day. Like maybe we're better off if we want to order something saying, you know, give me the slow boat free shipping.
That's a really good question. You know, I don't know if anyone has looked into the slow shipping, but there is certainly something about that instant gratification, not just being able to push the button, but to know that the thing is going to arrive and be in your hand in very short order. And maybe actually a lot of the pleasure would go away if you, you know, and so maybe it would work for a cookie in the sense that you can't stop your mouth from tasting it. So that's what I meant about you can't, you know, get the reward later. But, you know, you could always buy the cookie and then say, all right, well, you can eat it in, you know, 5 hours or something like that. Maybe at some point you just say, ah, forget it. Yeah, forget the cookie.
I'm not hungry anymore. Okay, yeah. So how does what people are working on in these seminars, and we'll describe those after we take a little break here, but how does that relate to what people might do in a traditional, like, psychotherapy setting or a counselor's office?
Hmm. Well, you know, this was something that actually worried me a little bit because it felt like some people were trying to use it as therapy. And I'm not sure that was actually the intent of the folks when they founded it. But, you know, traditional therapy, I mean, some of it does touch on this. You know, why do I feel aimless at work or why do I feel depressed or whatever? I think in general, you know, my sense is that traditional therapy really tries to get at, you know, some deeper, you know, kind of causes of this, you know, is there something that's really making you feel profoundly unhappy, you know, in your marriage or in your work life? You know, or are you maybe self-sabotaging? Maybe you don't want to succeed. You know, who knows? There are often very complicated things that you may want to unpack. And this applied rationality is much more kind of, I guess, without dismissing it, I would say it's sort of superficially practical. So it's more about, I guess they would argue that many things don't have a lot of deeper causes. And so if you're procrastinating on going to the gym or, you know, dragging your feet on going into work, maybe there's not a big thing there. Maybe there's a small thing that we can just fix.
Right. It's not that you didn't get along with your father, so you don't want to go to the gym. You just don't want to go to the gym.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Jennifer Kahn is my guest. She's a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine, which just published her article. It's called The Happiness Code. That's in the current issue. If you would like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. Back in 2 minutes with Jennifer Kahn.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Spring registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, literature, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with New York Times Magazine contributing writer Jennifer Kahn. Her article, The Happiness Code, appears in the current issue. It's about applied rationality and what it can do for people. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think, or email think@kera.org. Okay, Jennifer, there are these four-day seminars, one of which you attended to observe the process. And I have to imagine you were a little bit different than the average attendee.
You know, I was really struck by this. I walked in not having any idea who the other attendees were going to be. And then much to my surprise, as a woman in her 40s who's a professional writer and teacher, everybody else there was basically, I mean, under 30, certainly. Many of them were under 25 for a $4,000 conference. And every single one of them worked in the tech industry.
What is so appealing to people who work in the tech industry about this approach to self-improvement?
You know, I asked a lot of people at the conference that because I was so fascinated. You know, so to be fair, there's something, I should say that there's something slightly artificial here, which is that, you know, these days, the, you know, Center for Applied Rationality doesn't advertise very widely. So people tend to hear about it through word of mouth. So, mm-hmm. you know, part of the phenomenon is just because people are hearing about it from coworkers. So it stays within the tech industry. But beyond that, I did talk to a lot of people and they say it does appeal to them very specifically because so much of software, so much of programming is sort of an optimization problem. You know, you want to really optimize your code so it works, you know, with maximal efficiency and, you know, kind of like minimal kind of problems or, you know, bugs or anything like that. And so they often talk about, you know, this process of improving yourself as sort of debugging yourself. You know, can you figure out where these bugs are in your own mental, you know, processes and somehow, you know, fix them?
Now, it's not simply a matter of like pure calculated self-interest. The idea here, as organizers are eager to point out, is really balancing rational thought with the reality that human beings are complex and emotional creatures.
I'm really glad you brought that up because this was actually another thing that surprised me. They were very explicit about the fact that this wasn't about trying to be like Spock. It wasn't about trying to be, you know, the purely rational, I have no emotions, you know, I just reason and, you know, kind of being. Because, you know, and the reason that they don't have that view is that we don't work that way. You know, humans, it's just impossible for us to be that way. We're driven by all kinds of things. So the way they describe this, and this is actually comes from that guy, Daniel Kahneman, they talk about us having something called System 1 and System 2. So System 2 is the rational, you know, kind of like the very evolved part of our brain that does long-term planning and, you know, and complex calculations and all that. System 1 are these kind of, gut-driven, you know, impulses.
Cookie Monster.
Or, yeah, intuitions, emotions, you know, but also a bunch of other stuff. When you get that kind of creepy feeling that something's not right, you know, or something about this isn't making you happy. So that's the thing. It's there's the, you know, sort of the, you know, bad side, if you want to call it that, or sometimes that we, you know, get the cookie monster thing. We want the, you know, we want these things impulsively and it kind of ruins our long-term goals. But the good side is that often that system one is onto things well before our system two gets there. You know, it's aware that something is weird as we walk down the street, you know, or it's aware that we're maybe not that happy in our job. Maybe that's why, you know, maybe we're dragging our feet for a reason. So they want us to not ignore that system one, but to kind of improve the dialogue between the two sides.
So certain challenges would seem fairly straightforward, even if we are struggling to correct them, right? We want to quit wasting time on social media when there's work to be done. We want to manage our finances more responsibly. Other goals, though, are more complex, harder to define. So how can we apply rationality to making a decision that, for example, like changing careers?
Right. Well, one thing I think they would suggest is, you know, they have a thing called goal factoring. And what that means is you're supposed to, you know, take the thing that you plan to do. I want to change careers or whatever it is. And what you hope to get out of that. What's your goal? And then you try to sort of list all the, you know, sort of all the things that you hope to get from, you know, changing your career. Maybe it's more money. Maybe it's, you know, more control over the projects you work on or more interesting projects. Maybe it's more status, you know. And then you do this kind of mental exercise where you imagine that you could fulfill all those other goals, all those sub-goals some other way. You know, maybe you could get more money by asking your boss for a raise. Maybe you could get more status by, you know, blogging on the side. I have no idea. And then you imagine doing all those. And then you think, well, do I still want to switch jobs? And if you do, it usually means that there's a sub-goal that you're kind of hiding from yourself that you haven't identified, you know, so that, you know, maybe it's that there's something stressful in your workplace that you haven't really consciously been aware of. Or maybe it's just, you know, I don't know. Maybe you feel like your, you know, girlfriend or boyfriend doesn't really respect the job you're in and you secretly want to impress them by getting a more impressive job. And you're kind of not acknowledging that even to yourself.
So sometimes I would imagine people go through this exercise and they think, oh, all I really need to do is start volunteering and then I'm okay with staying in the job I'm in or something like that.
Yeah, I think sometimes – I think that's the idea is that it's to help you – there's actually something – you know, there's something called cognitive biases or kind of these broad category of ways that we fool ourselves. But one of them is actually, oddly, thinking that we understand our own motivations. and so that's what goal factoring is meant to correct is that, you know, we think we understand why we're doing – we think we understand why we're – all the time we think, oh, I know why I'm changing jobs. I'm not very happy. I don't really like my boss. But often there's stuff that we don't really recognize is, you know, playing a role in it. And so once you recognize it, you may still want to change your job, but you may actually realize, oh, I don't really need to. All I need to do is fix this one. Yeah, this is the one big problem, actually.
You write about a number of different cognitive errors that we all tend to make, but the one that will stick with me is what's called the IKEA effect, which means that if we've worked really hard on something, we tend to overvalue it more than the $169 we've paid or whatever it is.
Yeah, I love the IKEA effect. There's actually a lot of them I find kind of hilarious. There's, you know, the two that have probably meant the most to me, actually the three that meant the most to me besides the IKEA effect, there's something called unit bias that some people may have heard of, which is basically this idea of finishing, you know, the entirety of a thing. And so this plays itself out most often when we open a bag of cookies or a bag of popcorn and there's this kind of urge to finish it all, like to be like, I'm done. You
right.
know, I finished that off. And it gives you a little shot that you feel
something.
Good.
Right.
Exactly. And so, you know, and sometimes I do it procrastinating. I want to, quote, finish a section of the newspaper, you know, as though it makes somehow as though that's a win, like I finished it. So that's another funny one. And then to me, one of the apparently most interesting and most pernicious ones, according to Kahneman, is or two of them. One is anchoring bias, where we tend to rely when we make decisions really heavily on a single piece of information and usually the first one that we've learned. You know, so if we learn, you know, we're trying to make a decision about whether to change jobs and, you know, actually maybe that's a bad example about, you know, but whether to change jobs and we learn something about, you know, our company. We thought it was going to, you know, there were going to be raises this year and now there's not. And we really cling to that. And then, you know, even though we might learn a bunch of other information, you know, other companies aren't, you know, also aren't giving raises, whatever else, we really somehow get stuck on the one first piece of information we got.
I think about that in shopping sometimes. You know, you'll be in a store and there will be two sweaters that you like and they're $30 each, but one of them says it's marked down from 60 and one of them says it just started at 30. And somehow you think the $60 one is better, even if somehow you know you prefer the other one.
Yeah, absolutely. I know I have that all the time, too. And I'm not sure what exact bias that is, but there is something, you know, that happens there. If it costs more, it must be worth more. It's really an odd one.
So how can we make the cues that feed our habits, either good habits or bad habits, work for us instead of against us?
Well, there's a couple ways that I can mention at least briefly. One is really a very simple trick for building good habits. And they call it trigger action planning, which is kind of an elaborate term. But what it basically means is that you try to set stuff. So when I walk in the door, I will change into my gym clothes. So you kind of cue yourself. It's basically the way you'd cue a rat. You know, it learns that it pushes a lever and it gets a pellet. You know, but the idea is like when I walk in the door, that's what I do. I change into my gym clothes. Because you know, often the kinds of things that hang us up around going to the gym are we get home, we dump our stuff, you know, we go, whew, it's been a long day. We sit down for a while, we turn on the TV, and then suddenly we're like, forget it. I don't want to go to the gym. But if you just walk in and then you're in your gym clothes, you know, there's a much higher chance that you're going to go. So that's one good one. Another good one is called propagating urges. And that's what I talked about in terms of making a long-term goal feel more like a short-term urge. And that's a little trickier, but the idea is that most of us try to motivate ourselves with these kind of vague, not very convincing things. We vaguely, you know, we kind of want to be skinnier. We kind of want to be healthier. You know, these kind of virtuous goals. But they don't feel very immediate and really deeply visceral. And so the goal of propagating urges is to come up with really a really deep motivation, you know, for you. And so one person at the workshop was talking about how she was trying to get herself to kind of exercise more and was sort of thinking, well, maybe I'd be skinnier, maybe it would make me prettier. And then she's like, well, I could just like get better at, you know, how I could buy new clothes. I could get better at using makeup or something like that. And then she realized that actually, yeah, the real thing that was motivating, you know, would motivate her to exercise was that she wanted to feel like a badass. She wanted to feel tough. And so that became her kind of visceral thing that she held on to every time she had to think about whether she was going to go for a run. She would come up with a little mental picture of herself as kind of this badass woman. And that helped her more than kind of that feeling of should, you know, oh, I should do this. It's good for my cholesterol. You know, I know at some point I'll feel better if I succeed.
We talked about goal factoring. There's something called aversion factoring as well that I guess is sort of the opposite. You're looking at what's keeping us from our goals, from pursuing our goals.
Yeah, and this was an interesting one for me because I did it at the workshop. The premise is the same. In this case, you list all the reasons you're avoiding something that you really should do. It's important, you know, but you just you can't bring yourself to do it, right? And then you do a thing where you kind of go through and imagine fixing all those. You know, in my case, I didn't really want to talk to a financial planner. And so, you know, I listed a bunch of reasons why I didn't want to talk to the financial planner. And, you know, a lot of them make sense, right? You know, oh, it's a pain to get my records together, you know, or, you know, I don't know what. It's going to cost money to go to the planner or something like that. And so then I kind of had to do a mental exercise where I imagined, well, what if you know, my records could be got together without me even having to do something. What if the planner could just somehow magically do that? You know, and what if it was free or whatever? Did that fix my aversion? And in my case, I had to admit it didn't. And it was because I realized that in the end, actually, what the reason I didn't want to go to the financial planner was I was afraid of what they were going to tell me. I was afraid they were going to tell me that I needed to spend less and save more money. So I was, you know, I would never have suspected it. I thought I was just being lazy. I thought I was just being a little kind of avoidant because I didn't want to deal with money stuff. And it turned out at the root, you know, embarrassingly, I was afraid of what we're all afraid of. Like none of us wants to give up our good time, you know. So I sort of, it was very surprising.
Jennifer Kahn is my guest. She's a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. Her article, The Happiness Code, is available in the current issue of the magazine. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. We'll be back in 2 minutes with my guest, Jennifer Kahn, talking about The Happiness Code.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Spring registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, literature, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with New York Times Magazine contributing writer Jennifer Kahn. Her latest article in the current issue is called The Happiness Code. You can join us by emailing think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. I was really surprised to read, Jennifer, that these conferences, even though they cost $4,000, are not open to everybody. You have to apply and you have to be accepted.
Yeah, there are several reasons for that, I think. One of them is I kind of appreciated, which is that they said they didn't want a bunch of people, you know, who are coming in saying, all the people I work with are so irrational. I want to, fix them. So I want to, come to this course and learn, so I can go out there and tell them you're wrong for this reason. So they said they actually didn't want that. They wanted people who very earnestly wanted to engage with the material. But they're also trying to collect a lot of data so that just to get in, you have to do an in-person interview. You have to do this kind of self-report questionnaire where you assess your own, you kind of assess yourself, various personality traits and skills and stuff. And then they give the same questionnaire to a family member or a close friend so they can gauge how accurate you are. So, yeah, they really do filter their applicants.
And the idea is that to really make this work in your life, it's going to take some practice to form these more rational habits.
Yeah, and this is a place where it really diverges from the traditional forms of self-help, which, are more about, if you believe it, you can do it. And sort of you don't have to work very hard to create a big change in your life. They're saying that you actually do have to work quite hard. It's not enough just to know these kinds of tricks like the goal factoring or the trigger action planning or whatever. You really have to practice it until it's sort of second nature, until, this kind of, just the way, someone learning to play tennis would, it's awkward at the start. And then at some point you kind of start doing it automatically, have a kind of, oh, the ball's coming here. Now I know to use this stroke. And it's the same thing. A problem's coming at me in life or, hey, I'm noticing that I'm staying in bed a lot, checking Facebook and I'm always late to work. What's going on there? So, that's the idea.
So you took some useful ideas away from your time at the conference, but there were things about it that made you uncomfortable. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, this was part of what made the article very difficult to write, so it felt balanced this way. I actually thought many of the techniques they came up with were very interesting and useful. But unfortunately, the group has this connection to this guy, Eliezer Yudkowsky, and his organization, the Machine Intelligence Research Institute, which studies artificial intelligence. And it's just a slightly strange world. It's a world where, kind of culturally, everybody believes in cryonics, where you try to freeze your brain in hopes that it will eventually, in a future society, they'll be able to resuscitate you. There's a lot of interest in polyamory for no reason that I can detect. And then there's this kind of apocalyptic vision of artificial intelligence. And so people are a little strange. Like, these are very kind of communally held beliefs. And then the other thing I didn't like was that there's something kind of cultish about the way they run the workshops. Supposedly, this is to really immerse you in the kind of learning of these techniques. But there are basically no breaks. You're just slammed through these sessions. You are allowed to go to the bathroom and stuff. But basically, it's total immersion. Really, nobody leaves the house. When I tried to ask if I could sleep at home instead of sleeping in this group house, all the rooms are shared. They said, no. It's really very scientifically, it's been proven. It's very important that you stay on site the whole time. And so there's this kind of coercive element where they really – there's not a lot of room for you to breathe and think independent thoughts. Because constantly people are coming at you from all sides, saying, I know, isn't this great? Boy, rationality is really fascinating, isn't it?
Did you get like an L. Ron Hubbard vibe?
I talked to – so the thing was because I was getting this vibe, I tried to talk very transparently to a bunch of, participants about whether this was a cult while I was there. And the thing I appreciated was that they all engaged very honestly with the question. They didn't seem put off by it. And what they did say was that they thought it lacked the most pernicious elements of a cult. You know, no one was trying to get you to, you know, kind of regularly give money. You didn't have to, like Scientology style, give a lot of money to move up the ranks. They weren't trying to cut you off from your friends and family. You know, they weren't trying to tell you to, you can't have, you know, any contact with your mother if she's not a member of the your Church of Scientology. So they didn't use those kinds of, you know, really creepy pressure tactics. But that said, in terms of it being very groupthinky and a kind of a subtle pressure that if you're not thinking this way, you're not thinking right, you know, that was definitely there.
There was one person that you talked to that noted that, you know, everyone in my house, all my housemates are now practicing applied rationality as if like you're either in the in-group or not.
Yeah. And, you know, they seem to really like that. It basically to them, it kind of gives a common language to sort out problems and all this other stuff, you know, and then they can kind of use this shorthand. It's almost like, you know, I think as they see it, it's almost like if you just had a bunch of, you know, cyclists or runners in the same house, like you all have a shared interest and you can all, you know, you kind of all get up at 5 a.m. to go exercise or something, you know. So and I don't know if that's, you know, particularly I actually don't really know if that's a kind of a creepy culture space or not. But certainly the workshop felt a little coercive that way.
Is there talk, Jennifer, of using something like applied rationality to achieve more effective public policy?
Oh, yeah, actually, it's not. No one's calling it applied rationality, but basically behavioral economics is certainly being applied. And that's, you know, something that, you know, Daniel Kahneman got his Nobel Prize for. He's a professor at Princeton. And that kind of thing is, you know, the stuff that I think many of us are familiar with. Someone figured out that if we made, you know, 401k contributions, the default option rather than something you had to opt into, if you just took away that little bit of friction where you had to go to the site and figure it out and to set aside money and all the other stuff, if you just made it the default, almost everybody, you know, would just say, great, like automatically deduct this amount from my salary. And so then everyone became much more fiscally responsible and, you know, had this nice retirement fund. And all it took was that little switch was instead of, you know, greasing the wheels, instead of making people go through the hassle of signing up, you had to make them go through the hassle of opting out.
And some people call that nudge, which sounds a little less threatening and sort of easier to swallow.
Exactly. And it's, you know, it's the same thing. You know, I actually try to do it a little bit at home now. You know, I've read that one sort of the way that you don't have, you know, some grocery stores now don't have candy right near the registers because it makes you so susceptible to that impulse buy. Or maybe when you walk in the store, the first thing you see is vegetables rather than frozen TV dinners. So I actually try to do that now. I try to position things in my refrigerator and my cupboard so that the first thing I see is sort of, you know, an apple or broccoli or whatever it is, as opposed to, you know, yeah, some sort of, you know, bag of potato chips or something.
So lots of us have had experiences in different ways where you have this really intense experience. You want to make some changes in your life and then you get back to the regular world and it's a little bit harder. Do you have a sense based on your own experience of how long the effects of trying to think in these ways tends to last? Are participants in these conferences able to make changes that stick?
Yeah, and that is a great question because that is always the problem. And everyone at the conference was terribly worried. They basically were very, very keenly aware that they felt really passionate about it now at the conference. But when they went back to real life, they were they just weren't going to set aside time to really practice these things. It's, you know, it's both time consuming, you know, and effortful, right, which are both kind of off-putting features. But also sometimes it means that you're facing into problems that are really kind of unpleasant to face into. You know, maybe you have to acknowledge something you don't want to acknowledge, or maybe you have to face into an unpleasant emotion that you don't really want to feel. You just kind of want to scoot by. So it actually takes a lot of diligence to really keep practicing this. And I will say that, you know, I've been kind of, I think, loosely applying some of their techniques that I've found useful. But there's plenty of stuff, you know, despite doing all that aversion factoring around the financial planner, I still haven't gone. So that sort of gets at another point, which is that just realizing why you don't want to do something often isn't enough to by itself change how you behave.
Right. Well, maybe if you promise publicly here on the radio, maybe that will give you some incentive to go.
Really want to do it, there's actually an app out there called Stick, and that's the one that, you know, if you basically you pledge a bunch of money to something you hate.
Right.
You know, so if you're a gun control advocate, your money goes to the NRA or something like that, or vice versa, you know. And then basically if you haven't done it by a certain date, you pledge to lose weight by a certain date, you pledge to go to the financial planner by a certain date, and if you haven't done it, it automatically, you know, your money gets donated to the cause that you hate. So that's apparently a really effective way of getting you on the hook for something. something and actually making you follow through.
Jennifer Kahn is a contributing writer for The New York Times Magazine and author of an article called The Happiness Code that appears in the current issue. Jennifer, it's been really interesting. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Oh, thanks, Chris. It was my pleasure.